Hi everyone, I'm Alistair Willis, Music Director of the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. This year we're celebrating our 90th anniversary. And welcome to a new season of Aha with Alistair podcasts. Our opening programme is upbeat, fun and celebratory. We've Stravinsky's witty Pulcinella suite, Mozart's sublime third horn concerto, Rondo alla Mambo by Joshua Davis and Uniot Lombido, Joseph Bologna's overture to his opera The Anonymous Lover, and Darius Milhaud's romp of a piece called The Ox on the Roof. I've been dreaming about these concerts for a long time, and not just for the repertoire. Wherever I guest conduct, I'm always asked to bring a specific soloist with me the next time. I've worked with this soloist a couple of times in Germany on family concerts, but never in America nor on a masterwork. I can't tell you how thrilled I am that she's coming to South Bend. She's one of the best French horn players in the world, and she happens to be my sister, Sarah Willis. Sarah is a member of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. She performs, gives masterclasses all over the world. She's a TV presenter. Her horn hangouts, where she interviews today's top musicians, are watched by thousands. And recently, she's been spending a lot of time in Cuba, doing several projects, including an album called Mozart y Mambo with the Havana Lyceum Orchestra. On it, she plays Mozart's third horn concerto, also arrangements of Mozart Cuban style, and Cuban standards arranged for the French horn. And I caught up with my famous sister by phone at her home in Berlin. Sarah, it is great to see you.
It's great to see you too, because you know what, dear listeners, Alistair is a very busy man, conductor in South Bend and a family man. He doesn't have that much time. So to actually see him now on Zoom is a great treat. It's usually Christmas and birthdays.
Nowhere near how busy you are. So this is really a treat for me. Thank you for being with us today. We're so excited that you're going to be here to open our season. We can't wait to have you here. Now, let's dive straight in. Two of the pieces you're playing are on your award-winning fusion Mozart y Mambo album. Now, how did all that come about?
Well, Mozart y Mambo basically means Mozart and Mambo, and that's exactly what this album is. It's a Cuban album. We mixed Mozart with a little bit of Cuban music because I love Cuban music. I mean, who doesn't? I fell in love with it when the Buena Vista Social Club came out, and I wanted to dance salsa. I learned how to dance salsa to that music. And so the first time I went to Cuba in 2017, it was actually so that I could dance some decent salsa. But I met the Havana Lyceum Orchestra there. And this is an orchestra, a chamber orchestra of young, talented Cuban musicians. And I heard them play Mozart. And I was literally blown away because I hadn't gone to Cuba to listen to Mozart. I wanted to hear all the dance music. But I went to this concert, and the way this orchestra plays, it is incredible. They dance while they play. They look happy while they play. They are music. It's not just music in Cuba is not something you do as a hobby. It's just part of their DNA. It's part of their life. So I gave a masterclass the next day on the French horn, and I didn't even know whether there were any French horn players in Cuba, but quite a lot turned up. And once again, I use this phrase blown away, but it was literally that they make such beautiful music on such terrible instruments. The horns were in a terrible state. In the middle of the class, I wanted to show one of the girls something on her horn. I picked up her horn and half of it came away in my hand. And she said, oh, don't worry about that. It happens all the time. And then she fixed it with her hairband. And I just thought I had to do something here. So this project, this crazy project, Mozart y Mambo, this mixture of Cuban and Mozart music, it just sort of took shape there. It took a couple of years to get my plans organized. And the first album came out in 2020. And we had no idea that the world was going to like it. Because, of course, there's some purists out there that say, how could you do that with Eine kleine Nachtmusik, put a Mozart in with a Cuban beat? But it was very important to me to do it all of a very high quality. And we have the Mozart Horn Concerto number 3 on the album, as you said. We mixed a little bit of Mozart and Mambo by creating this wonderful piece, Rondo alla Mambo. And there's beautiful Cuban songs on there as well. So we did a bit of all this. We put it all out there. It went straight to number 1 in the classical charts over here in Europe. People went absolutely, as we say in England, bananas for it. And so I'm coming to South Bend. We're a little bit behind the times in South Bend, I must say, because we're playing music from the first album, but the second album has just come out. So so I'm excited to be there and to actually experience your audience getting to know this wonderful project.
Your brother has also went bananas when it came out. It is fantastic. And didn't you say somewhere that, or someone said to you that Mozart would have made a good Cuban?
My musicians told me exactly that. And when I said why, they said, well, first of all, it's the dance element in Mozart's music. You know, he wrote a lot of dance music into his pieces. And I think the last movements of all the Mozart horn concertos are a great example of this. These 6/8, it's something you can dance to. It's something you can move to. Mozart also had a lot of improvisation in his music. When he gave soirees, he played for friends in living rooms, in the palaces or wherever he had to play, he would always improvise on his themes. He would do variations which weren't written down. Most of the stuff that he improvised is not written down, but the Cubans can really relate to that because Cuban music is full of improvisation. They take one tune and then they improvise on it for hours. So there's that. The other reason they told me was that Mozart, as far as I know, was very good with the ladies. And Cubans reckon they are too. So that was another thing they had in common. And funnily enough, there is a statue of Mozart in the old town in Havana Vieja. And I was so astonished to see that. I took a walk one of those first days I was in Havana. And I went past the statue. I thought, funny, that looks familiar. It doesn't look all that much like Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, but there was enough to make me stop and look again. And there's really a sign under it saying Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So they almost got it right.
That's fantastic. Well, on your first album, you've recorded Mozart number 3. Now, I grew up lucky enough to hear you play all 4 of the concertos at home. Why did you choose number 3 to kick off this first album? What's so special about it?
There's musical reasons and personal reasons for that. The personal reason is that the third movement of the Mozart Third Horn Concerto was the first Mozart I ever performed in public. And you probably don't even remember this, but it was with the Walton and Weybridge Youth Orchestra.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was pretty awful. The clarinets split more notes than I did, and the violas got lost. But, we performed it in Kingston at a church. And no, I think it was in someone's school. It's so long ago. But I remember standing there, and I remember performing it. And Mum and Dad were proud, of course. I don't even know if you were there. Sorry, forgot that.
I don't remember, but I'm sure I loved it if I was
I'm
there.
I'm sure you did. But but I think we need to tell your listeners the story of us practicing at home. Now, Alistair is a very good, you probably aren't anymore because you don't practice, a good trumpet player. So he would practice upstairs very loudly. My sister, who didn't play any musical instrument, was like on the middle floor, and I was on the ground floor practicing my horn. So my sister was a brass sandwich. And and Mozart 3 was just, it's considered maybe the less technically challenging one of all the Mozart horn concertos because it doesn't have any high notes in it. Now, of course, we like to put some high notes in the cadenza and make it as elaborate as we can. But I find Mozart Third Horn Concerto actually one of the most complicated ones musically. It's a tough one to set up musically and to tell a story with. It's a little bit like an opera. And I find the French horn is like the hero, like the tenor, telling a story about love and life. And I think the only way to play this well is to be able to sing it well as well. Well, as well as your voice.
As well as dance. Yeah. As well as dance it, right?
You've got to dance it and sing it. You've got to feel it in your whole body. I think the more you can do that with music, the better music is.
It's amazing hearing you say that because several conductors, some of my teachers and mentors have encouraged me over the years to look at Mozart symphonies as mini operas without the singers. So the first melody could be the heroine, the counter melody, and the bass could be the jealous stepfather or something. And you create these dramatic scenarios. And I can see perfectly how that would fit and apply to Mozart's Third Horn Concerto.
Well, I think the thing there is that there are singers. And I think it's an opera with singers, just not with the classical singers that we know using their voices. But the singers are the members of the orchestra who have these tunes and have these dialogues with each other. And also, it doesn't have to be only the melody. You could have the violas being the weather, good old violas.
Right.
Or the winds being a cheeky animal, or, you know, you can make it into whatever you want. And that's the great thing about music, is that it can be whatever you want. No one person experiences music the same as another person. And that's great. And that's really good that it's like that. And so you can basically turn it into whatever you want it to be. Make up your own opera.
I can't wait, and our audiences here are going to just absolutely love you. It'll be a Willis and Willis. We performed in Germany with some family concerts, but we've never done a masterworks like this before. This is such a special occasion for me and for us, and travel safe. It's going to be great weather while you're here too, so make sure you pack some warm clothes.
How do you think your South Bend audience are going to be on the dance floor? Do you think they'll get a little bit of rhythm going with these Cuban pieces, or what do you think?
I think if anybody can get them up and dancing, it'll be you. And maybe you and I will show them something from the stage to inspire them.
Well, we don't want to scare anyone thinking they're going to have to get up and dance. They might not come to the concert because, you know, classical audiences sometimes don't like to be surprised. But my whole mission as a horn player and a musician is to try and do things a little bit differently, to try and reach a larger audience, a broader audience, sometimes reach people that think that they may not be interested in classical music. So this is what this Mozart y Mambo project has been about. Of course, it's a bit crazy. But on the other hand, with the Mambo part of it, we were reaching people who were in the Latino charts, who were interested in that. But then if they got the album, then they had to listen to a bit of Mozart. And the other way around, the Mozart fans were listening to some Cuban music. So This is the thing that I think is it keeps us all spiced up. But I don't want your audience to think they're going to have to get up and dance. But if I see a few shoulders going or a few feet tapping, I'll be happy.
We'll have more than that going, I am sure. You are just amazing. I've always looked up to you, Sarah, and you've done amazing things, not just for the horn, but for music, and for me. You are my biggest inspiration. I've said that a million times, and I'm saying that to you now. I just want to know one thing. With your recent appointment of receiving an MBE from the royal family, do I have to call you Lady Sarah from now on?
No, but you have to curtsy when you see me.
Right, got it. Wonderful. We'll do that. Well, I'll practice that until you get here.
And make me tea in the mornings.
Oh, absolutely.
And foot rubs.
Oh, hang on. Well, now we're going too far, perhaps.
And horn polishing.
Before Mozart, we'll open our concert with the suite from Stravinsky's ballet, Pulcinella. This ballet was commissioned in 1920 by Serge Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe, for whom Stravinsky had already composed the groundbreaking Firebird, Petrushka, and The Rite of Spring. In these, Stravinsky had pushed rhythmic and harmonic complexities to their absolute limits, but these were before World War I. By 1920, the world had changed, and so had Stravinsky. Diaghilev had discovered an early 18th century Commedia dell'arte libretto with music by Italian composers Pergolesi, Gallo, and Monza, and was keen to turn it into a ballet. Stravinsky wasn't so interested until he studied the music. Stravinsky saw a chance to do something different. and Pulcinella marked the beginning of Stravinsky's second phase as a composer, his neoclassical period. Gone were the barbaric rhythms and intense complexities of The Rite of Spring and the huge forces needed. Now, a smaller, more classical-sized orchestra was required with more classical structures. Stravinsky ended up keeping most of the original melodies. He subtly adjusted phrases and harmonies by adding notes and repeated passages, and he colors it all with his unique orchestration and transparency. To me, the result is an experience of 18th century music through a 20th century lens. He wrote, quote, "Pulcinella was my discovery of the past. It was a backward look, of course, the first of many love affairs in that direction, but it was a look in the mirror, too." End of quote. This one-act ballet is a comedy. Again, something we wouldn't naturally have associated with Stravinsky before World War I. From the opening notes, we hear a sense of positivity and joy. Premiere, to those familiar with his early ballets, that must have been quite the shock. Pulcinella is a stock character of Commedia dell'arte, a crafty character who often plays dumb in order to get his own way. He's sought out by all the girls and always in danger of being killed by their boyfriends, a bit like Punch, as in Punch and Judy. The story revolves around him and his girlfriend Pimpinella, and their friends Prudenza and Rosetta, Florindo and Clovello, and Furbo. The characters, their dancing, serenading, jealousy, naughtiness, shenanigans, are brought to life in the light, witty, and sophisticated score. Stravinsky features a solo string quartet played by our principal players, and all instruments have fantastic and virtuosic parts. One of my favorite sections is the seventh movement, the Vivo, which describes a scuffle between two of the boyfriends, portrayed by a trombone and a double bass, hoping to reclaim their girlfriends. Such fun. The ballet ends happily with a triple wedding and several rejoicing high C's for the trumpet. After intermission, we'll hear music by Joseph Bologna, the Chevalier of Saint-Georges, who was the first known classical composer of African descent and one of the most remarkable figures in music history. Not just a prolific composer, he was also a violinist and concertmaster of prestigious Parisian orchestras with whom he frequently performed his own violin concertos and symphonies. He was also responsible for commissioning and conducting Haydn's six Paris symphonies. He was an expert fencer and became revered as one of the best swordsmen in all of Europe, even being made an officer in the court of Louis XV, earning the title of Chevalier. John Adams, America's second president, met Joseph Bologna and praised him in his diary, quote, "He is the most accomplished man in Europe in riding, running, shooting, fencing, dancing, music." Despite the hostility and racism of some, Joseph Bologna was relatively accepted in Parisian society, having the admiration and respect of the king himself. He was a favorite of Marie Antoinette, with whom he occasionally played chamber music. When Mozart came to Paris, he was greatly influenced by the music of Joseph Bologna. In fact, Mozart was highly jealous of Bologna's genius and regarded him as his nemesis, which must have been quite awkward in 1778 when Mozart stayed under the same roof in Paris as Bologna for 2.5 months. The next year, Bologna composed his second symphony, and a year after that he repurposed it as the overture to his opera L'Amante Anonyme, which means The Anonymous Lover, and used its musical themes throughout the opera. The overture is in the style of an Italian opera sinfonia, having three sections, fast, slow, fast. The opera sinfonia was a precursor to the multi-movement symphony that we know today. Let's hear a snippet from the positively upbeat first movement. The second movement is for strings only and could be mistaken for a second movement of an early classical string quartet. The third movement is remarkably similar to a finale of an early Haydn symphony. Our concerts will mark the South Bend Symphony Orchestra's first performances of this piece. We follow this overture with The Ox on the Roof by French composer Darius Milhaud, a piece that's very special to me. It had a huge impact on my early musical career. When I was about 15, I played it with a youth orchestra called the Jupiter Band, which had the same initials, JB, as their inspiring conductor, Jonathan Butcher. I was in awe of the trumpet part. A cool, swinging melody comes back many times, each time in a different key. I remember working on this with my trumpet teacher and absolutely loving it. I recall the piece was jazzy, that at times it sounded completely kooky with instruments playing in different keys at the same time, which I'd never before experienced. Here's the opening, which plunges immediately into the theme. This piece is infused with jazz and Brazilian rhythms, including sambas, tangos, and even a Portuguese fado, all thanks to the composer spending a couple of years in Rio de Janeiro during World War I and returning home via New York, where he was greatly impressed with the jazz halls of Harlem. To me, the key to really appreciating this piece is understanding the title. Le Bœuf sur le Toit translates to the ox on the roof. But what on earth does that mean? Is it the name of a Brazilian folk dance? Milhaud says it is. But Milhaud also said that he composed it as a background to any Charlie Chaplin silent movie. And this certainly could account for its comedic musical character, but there's no Charlie Chaplin movie by that name. There is a Parisian legend about a man in a top-floor apartment who insisted on keeping a calf, which grew into a large ox too big to be removed. Can you imagine? I just love that legend, but the music is hardly descriptive of an animal. There was a Parisian nightclub called Le Boeuf sur le Toit, and that is the connection. And the story behind this is fantastic. Jean Cocteau, the influential French poet and foremost creative of the surrealist, avant-garde, and Dadaist movements, was a friend of Mio. And when he heard Mio's score, he suggested some kind of a stage show. Cocteau approached the Count of Beaumont for financial backing, and they booked the Comédie des Champs-Élysées. And a few days later, as good fortune would have it, the entire theatre was sold out. The Shah of Persia paid 10,000 francs for a front row seat, from which he couldn't see anything, but was in full view of everyone. Cocteau created a pantomime scenario for the music, set in an American bar during the Prohibition. Mio wrote, quote, "The characters were highly typical. A boxer, a Negro dwarf, a lady of fashion, a red-headed woman dressed as a man, a bookmaker, a gentleman in evening clothes, and a barman who serves drinks to everyone present." End quote. So after some roughhousing, some brawls, much laughing and tipsy dancing, a policeman enters, and, are you ready for this? The American bar is instantly transformed into a milk bar. The clients act out a rustic scene and dance a pastorale as the clients sip their milk drinks. The barman switches on a huge fan, which decapitates the policeman. The red-headed woman dances, standing on her hands. The customers slowly depart, swaying in all directions, and the proceedings end with the barman presenting a huge bill to the now-resuscitated policeman. The characters were played by clown acrobats from two noted circus troupes. And to contrast the lively tempo of the music, Jean Cocteau made all the characters move slowly, as in a slow-motion film. How I would have loved to have been at that premiere. As I listen, I love to let my mind loose to imagine these wild scenes. The sauciness, the romp, the double entendres, and much more are all in the music, jumping off the page at us. Thanks for listening, everyone.